from the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, those open lines followed by a tribute to the late ufologist Ed Grimsley, who passed away. Here's what's happening. The Internal Revenue Service now saying that more than twice as many taxpayer accounts might have been hit by cyber criminals than the agency previously reported. Oh boy, with hackers gaining access to as many as 700,000 accounts and attempting to break into an additional 575,000. This disclosure is the second revision by the IRS in the last 6 months. Donald Trump's endorsement from New Jersey Governor Chris Christie opens up a wide network of donors, advisors, and prominent elected officials whom the billionaire has not yet been able to attract to his bid for the Republican presidential nomination. As Trump tries to lock up the Republican nomination on Super Tuesday, that's next week, Christie advisors and supporters say that he could bring much-needed financial and strategic backing. We shall see. Perhaps are we looking at a Trump-Christie? Could that be? You never know. Well, the gunman who killed three people and wounded several others at that Kansas plant where he worked had been served a restraining order less than 2 hours before he opened fire. The shooter is identified now as 38-year-old Cedric Ford. He's dead. Showed no indication that he'd unleash a rampage when the protection from abuse order was served on Thursday afternoon. The sheriff described Ford as upset at the time, but not unusually so. Still, the sheriff said the order likely triggered the shootings. Sad story there. The order of protection usually filed because some type of violence is in a relationship. And like I mentioned, the gunman was killed as well. And a man fatally shot four people believed to be members of his own family, then kept people at bay for several hours on Friday before killing himself in the state of Washington. Why all this sickness? Let's check in with resident psychiatrist Dr. Peter Breggin. Peter, this is going on way too much. What's going on here? Why are people acting this way?
Well, there certainly is an increase. I was really a little surprised to see. If you count mass shootings as like four people wounded or killed, the rates have been going up, and they've gone up a lot in the last few months. You know, nobody has a real answer. But I was looking at all the ways we're showing people the possibility of killing each other. And we have it on TV news. We have it on video games. We have it on movies, all the serials. So unlike any other time in history, people are constantly seeing vengeful killings. Most of this is about revenge. Most of it's about humiliation and getting even.
But you kill somebody over that, Peter? I mean, like this guy in Kansas. So he gets a restraining order against him. Big deal. Back off. Be done. Instead, you go out and kill people?
Yeah, well, I don't think it has to do with people being, clinically insane or crazy most of the time.
They snap, though, at a moment.
They snap. I don't think it's all got to do with psychiatric drugs either, though the largest ones, the big ones like the Colorado shootings, involve psychiatric drugs. I think we've created a culture where violence is so much a part of our media lives, our movies, our newspapers, it's television. I just think it inures people to it. It's something you just see all the time now. You know, I talked to a little boy one day about why he could imagine killing people but not animals. And he said, well, you don't see animals getting killed on TV and all the time and in video games.
Oh,
but people are getting killed all the time.
How old was the little boy?
4 years old.
4 years old. So, I mean, as a psychiatrist, I mean, aren't you concerned about somebody like that? He's four. What's he going to be like when he's 20, Peter?
Well, yes, that's right, although at least this little boy is sensitive enough to be talking about it. But that's right, it could be more and more of a serious issue. But I think we really do have to face this impossible, seemingly impossible problem we have, which is that every time you turn on the TV or you go to the movies or you watch TV and movies, you see people killing each other. You see all this violence. I don't know how to get around that, but there's no way that growing up in that environment isn't going to encourage you to think of violence.
It's not just
guns, because we've had guns around.
No, it's not the guns.
Before the Revolutionary War. Something else is going on about the acceptance of taking out your frustration and your violence by shooting people.
Yeah, I think so. Peter, do some homework on this for us and maybe come back for a little longer version of the show. This is just something I've been talking about for 2 years now, that I think people are acting weird, something crazy is happening, and we're seeing this time and time again. In Colorado, a bill introduced in the state house would require the reporting of non-vaccinated students to the Colorado Department of Health and Environment. Currently, those records are kept with just the school. A strain of so-called, listen to this, super lice has hit a reported 25 states, causing concern and frustration among parents because the bugs now cannot be killed with most over-the-counter treatments. The treatments once had a 100% success rate back in the year 2000 against lice, but now they only work, they say, in about 25% of the cases. The lice have developed an immunity to this. Now, other companies are trying to come up with ways to kill off the lice, but it's unbelievable. The expert in pandemics and diseases and viruses, Dr. Gary Ridenour, with us. How bad is this situation, Gary? 25 states?
It is 25 states, and we have 6 to 12 million cases a year. We have an outbreak in the Nevada schools right now. Lice have been with us forever. They've been found on mummies stuck in their hair. The reporting of this new louse, there's not really good substantial evidence to back up what the super louse is and what it's doing. The best treatment over the counter is called Nix shampoo, and you rub it in and follow the directions. The lice also lay little egg sacs on your hair that you can see that are called nits, and you have to get a nit comb to comb those out of there and treat the lice, hopefully to kill them. Sometimes you may have to use the nits a couple of times on these guys to get rid of them. There's a prescription chemical called SK lice that you have to go to the doctor to get. They don't live long off of a human body, so what you do is you wash the bed clothes, use the clothes dryer so that you kill them, vacuum your floors, and the big thing is don't shave your head.
Yeah, and some people have done that just because they panic. Gary, thank you so much. Head lice, 25 states. People who are obese have a worse memory than their thinner friends, according to a new study. Tests on 50 people showed being overweight was linked to worse episodic memory or the ability to remember past experiences. A woman has been arrested in the capital of Nairobi. She cut out her child's tongue and intestines because she wanted to free him from demons. Well, obviously, she's been arrested. What's going on in the skies this week? Let's check in now with Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Hey, Peter, what do we have this week?
Well, good evening, George, and a happy Friday.
You too, sir.
Always nice to be here at the end of the week. four very, very interesting cases. We just updated our website late tonight with about 105 new reports received just since last Friday. A lot of them really, really interesting. But to summarize, February 10th, we just received a report yesterday from a woman in Watchung, New Jersey. That's about 15 or 20 miles west of Newark Airport. She writes, and she writes very well. She's an executive project manager, so probably a very capable young woman. On the 10th of February, I think that was a Friday or Wednesday morning, she pulled out of her driveway on her way to the gym at 5:15 in the morning. I give her credit for that. I couldn't even get out of bed.
Motivation there, Peter. Motivation.
That's about the time I'm going to bed. But she pulled out, and as she rounded the corner, her peripheral vision picked up an object that was in the sky, she thought, just above her, and she quickly looked back at it. She saw an immense triangular craft. It was charcoal gray, she says, moving very slowly just above the treetops. As if that was not enough, about 2 minutes later, she was very close to her exit or entrance onto Interstate 78, and she saw it again in the distance heading north-northeast. Very interesting case. She says it was absolutely silent. She was very surprised by that sighting, and the fact that she saw it twice, not just once, suggests that it was moving way much slower than a airliner would be expected to fly, or any kind of military aircraft. Very interesting report. 3 days ago, February 23rd, a gentleman whose name would be widely recognized in the astronomy community of amateur astronomers in the Puget Sound region, was looking out his window facing the north just in time to see a cluster of these yellow lights streak from his right to left, that is, from east to west. He had the presence of mind to grab a camera. He got a very nice photo of them. The photo is posted to the UFO Center website now, to the homepage. Very interesting report. He said he's never in his life paid a moment's attention to the UFO phenomenon. This one caused him to sit up and pay notice. Very interesting report and good photos and good illustrations of where all this happened. We got a second report from another independent witness as well. Both of those reports are posted to our website now. This morning, southeast Spain, a city called Daimus, I believe it is pronounced, D-A-I-M-U-S. It's on the eastern shore of Spain, right on the Mediterranean. This morning at 1:15 a.m. local time in Spain, three adults got home and were very surprised to see two immense triangular craft drift over the house where they were staying on vacation.
They're everywhere.
As they disappeared over the house, they ran around to the other side. They got to the other side just in time to see the two triangular craft stop and hover in the morning sky. A few seconds later, they described the objects just accelerated straight vertical, vertically straight up into the night sky and disappeared from their sight. And this evening, Chandler, Arizona, which, as you probably know, just southeast of Phoenix, gentlemen heard what he quickly identified to be a military helicopter approaching. Just about the time his house started shaking from the reverberation from the blades, he saw a helicopter with a triangle of white lights just ahead of it. He could not see a craft attached to those white lights, but they were just ahead of the helicopter. It was almost, he says, as if the helicopter were pursuing the white lights. And there are about 100 more very interesting reports on our website.
Great.
Put them there just tonight.
Thank you, Peter. Have a good week. Up next, we're going to be talking about the Brotherhood of the Wheel. Truck driver ghost stories next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you. And let me tell you about our guest who's going to be with us for the next hour and a half plus. Rod Belcher is an award-winning newspaper and magazine editor and reporter. Rod has been a private investigator, a DJ, a comic book store owner, and has degrees in criminal law, psychology, justice, and risk administration from Virginia Commonwealth University. He's done master's work in forensic science at the George Washington University. He's worked with the Occult Crime Task Force for the Virginia General Assembly as well. His work, the latest, The Brotherhood of the Wheel. We're talking about truck driver ghost stories. What a great idea, Rod. Welcome to the program.
Hi, George. It's very wonderful to be here. Thank you for having me on.
Boy, I got to tell you, over the years, we've had some incredible stories from truck drivers. I mean, that just chill you, and you picked up on it.
Absolutely. I have admired truckers for quite a while. I grew up in Salem, Virginia, and literally the interstate was in our backyard, so I would hear the trucks going by every night, and it is a fascinating life. It really is one of those kind of occupations that I think certain people have a calling to, and They lead a very lonely life. They do a great service for us. They a huge amount of the cargo and goods and certain goods that we buy in the stores are delivered by truck, a huge amount. So we rely on them, and we really don't even, I think most time, even think about that.
How did you get involved in this story, the Brotherhood of the Wheel?
Well, I was a newspaper guy for quite a few years, and did a lot of journalism and a lot of nonfiction stuff, and got fortunate enough to sell a novel in 2013, my first one, and that has led into a career so far. I'm going to knock on some wood here and hope I keep keep on having a career doing that. But I had this idea knocking around in my head since the 90s for kind of the notion of a novel with kind of everyman heroes. And I wanted to use truckers, state police troopers, 1% biker guys as my heroes. And I managed to find a kind of a historical underpinning for it. And fortunately, my agent liked the idea enough to encourage me to pursue it, and wrote Brotherhood last year.
That's a great idea. Great idea.
Thank you. I'm really excited about it, and it seems to be being very well received so far.
Tell us about the methods you use to do the research on the truck drivers, the bikers, police officers.
Well, I'm fortunate enough to know some folks in those professions, just from from life experiences. But I wanted to try to capture as much of that as I could. I had some friends who friends of friends who were truck drivers, long haul truckers, and was actually offered the opportunity to go out and ride along for about a month on the road. Unfortunately, I'm a parent, and my kids, I really couldn't leave them for a month. And my mother was also very sick at the time, and we were taking care of her. So I didn't get a chance to actually do a ride along. I was looking forward to doing that a lot, and maybe I'll get a chance to do that one day. But I was able to pick these people's brains, hear some of their stories, and I also went on to some of the trucker websites and kind of BBS type things where, truckers talk back and forth to each other, and got to get some really great stories from them. And actually, when I found out I was going to be on your show, I put out a call on my social media, Facebook and Twitter, for any good stories, any juicy stories mm-hmm. that might be able to throw my way. And I actually got feedback up until today, so I actually was able to find out some of these stories, and very excited from the reception. But I pretty much talked to as many folks as I could. This is actually first book in a series. Next book is going to focus a little bit more on bikers. So I'm probably going to try to do some research with them too, which ought to also be kind of interesting. I can't wait to hear what kind of haunted biker stories there are. But I was very fortunate in having a lot of very nice people who are willing to share their time and just to share with me some of their experiences. And it's been very interesting.
Well, when we open up the phone lines next hour, Rod, we'll get all kinds of stories, I think, from truck drivers.
Can't wait.
In addition to some of yours. Tell us about the FBI's Highway Serial Killer Initiative. What is that?
Well, I found out about that doing research for this book, and it was really fascinating, kind of eye-opening. I found a book by a woman named Ginger Strand called Killer on the Road, which is a discussion of how the development of the highway system seems to have dovetailed with the emergence of serial criminals. It turns out that the FBI had a huge number of unsolved multiple murder cases all across America. They created the Highway Serial Killer Initiative as a part of I believe it's called the Violent Criminal Apprehension Program, which I believe is their profiling branch out of Quantico. And the Highway Serial Killer Initiative was basically a program to take data from all of these unsolved murders and correlate them with highways and see if they could find patterns. And sure enough, they did find some patterns. They started it in the 90s, and as far as I know, it is still ongoing. But serial killers, and this, you know, came to light with Ted Bundy and Edmund.
Oh my gosh! Let's talk more about that. Then we'll get into some of these legends and supernatural trucker stories in the book, of course, The Brotherhood of the Wheel. And welcome back. We're back with Rod Belcher. We're talking about his work, The Brotherhood of the Wheel. Let's talk a little bit more about this FBI's Highway Serial Killer Initiative, and then we'll get into some of these incredible stories, Rod, that you were able to uncover. So are they successful with this initiative?
If I'm not mistaken, in the first year they were in business, I think they cleared 25 cases, which is impressive. FBI is a little wary to present exactly, you know, what the overall number of cases are they have that they're working. They did, however, say, and this was early on when in the program, that about at any given time they were looking at about 200 operating serial killers running
in this
back
country
across America.
Yeah.
And
a definition of a serial killer is more than one in terms of who they kill?
Yes. It basically, they don't know their victims. They kill, and then there's a cooling off period, which is what differentiates it from a mass murderer, which we had all these terrible shooting events lately.
They don't stop.
Those are considered mass killings because the person tends to go and just keep killing people until he's stopped. Serial killers, usually there'll be some kind of a cooling off period, and they're kind of on a cycle, and they'll continue doing that. So you may have one person who over the course of like a decade kills dozens of people. And if you combine that with someone who their job takes them across state lines and across the interstate highway, it can be very challenging to connect those crimes. And that was actually one of the things that the highway system seems to have acted as sort of a benefit for these type of killers, because they had easy access from, you know, find a victim, kill that victim. They could travel overnight to another state or several states and drop the body there. So the highway initiative was actually a really useful tool for law enforcement in starting to look at the big picture and starting to see patterns in all this chaos.
You know, in our days, Rod, and I go way back, people used to pick up hitchhikers. You know, you'd see somebody on the side of the road, you felt sorry for them, people would pick them up.
Right.
I don't know if that's happening anymore. I can't wait till the truckers call us next hour. I want to ask them that question too.
You know, I recall, I'm a kid of the 70s, and I recall my sister and I would walk places, and I remember, you know, at the time we were always, you know, admonished not to hitchhike. But I do recall that, you know, sometimes that happened, and, you know, in the late 60s and the early 70s were a little more innocent time, which is really funny because if you look back, it really wasn't that innocent a time. But now, looking forward now, it was sort of a more innocent time as far as how trusting people were of strangers. And I think that there's probably still a little hitchhiking that goes on. But one of the things that was really interesting in researching the book was how many hitchhikers ended up as victims of a random killer, a serial killer.
Absolutely.
And again, it's a very small percentage of the overall population. It's not like there's a serial killer on every corner. But if you look at the patterns, there certainly was a period of time, 60s, 70s, probably up into the 80s, where that kind of behavior was not quite as...
It was more accepted.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That has led to, you know, nowadays I think most parents and most kids are pretty scared, would be pretty scared to hitchhike, but I'm sure there are still people who do it. I've seen them on the highways myself.
I think so too. Let's get into some of the supernatural here that's in your book, The Brotherhood of the Wheel. Tell us about this legend of a black dog, and how does that tie into things?
The black dog is really fascinating. I found it in quite a bit of different places. It seems to be one of the kind of cornerstone myths of kind of the trucker culture. The black dog, it appears in different ways. Sometimes it's a blur, a furry blur that moves across the road. One account I read, the trucker thought he had hit a dog, and he stopped the truck, and he was and one of the things that kind of run a thread that runs through all the different tellings of the story is that the trucker is really tired. Because, I mean, you drive, you know, you have to hit a destination by a certain point. You've got so many miles to cover. A lot of times truckers are usually exhausted or tired. The black dog supposedly shows up as a warning. There's been cases where truckers have looked over out of their driver, you know, out of their passenger driver side window and seen this big black dog, you know, keeping up with them.
Mm-hmm. No, red eyes?
Sometimes red eyes, sometimes not. Sometimes the dog will appear in the road in front of the truck. It is kind of universally believed that the black dog is a portent. It's a warning that you are going to have an accident. You're going to wreck and quite possibly die. And truckers have come to you know, take some stock in this. So if you see the black dog, it's time to pull over and get some rest. So it's... and
ominous.
It's really interesting because the story has, you know, some variation to it, but there's a lot of stuff in it that is very, you know, similar. And it does seem to be something that truckers have talked about for several generations of truck drivers. And what's really interesting is it has a lot of parallels to mythology that goes back to, you know, basically to Celtic times, and the wild hunt, which was supposedly, you know, these dogs that would chase you, and there was if you saw the wild hunt, it would meant your doom. You were marked for death, and it's just kind of interesting that, you know, that there's that thread that runs through the whole story, and I think I saw the black dog more than any other trucker story or supernatural story related to driving, truck driving. That seems to be, like I said, kind of a cornerstone story.
Let's get into some of the stories in the book that have come your way. Supernatural, ghostly, what are some of your favorites?
Oh, well, this is one that I received from a gentleman.
And I should say the book, The Brotherhood of the Wheel, is a novel, right?
Yes. Yeah, that's correct. It's fiction. But it's a genre called urban fantasy, which is basically taking our modern world and infusing fantastic supernatural elements into it, and I tried to include as much of the kind of the mythology and the stories that had been that I had been collecting from folks who drive trucks for a living, and work that into the story. And I also tried very hard to make it, you know, kind of realistic. I wanted truck drivers to, if they read this, not to feel you know, insulted or feel like I didn't know what I was talking about. Because like I said, I have a great deal of respect for the folks who do that job. And having a background in forensic science, I know, like, for example, a lot of the CSI shows and things like that, they drive me nuts because you watch them and a lot of the stuff just doesn't seem to be realistic. It's not what my experience has shown me. So I wanted to try to make it a nice combination of supernatural elements from these stories that I've kind of been trying to collect, and fiction. So, but yeah, I one of the stories I got that was very interesting involves a entity known as Smokey Joe.
Smokey Joe. Tell us
Smokey
about
Joe.
Smokey Joe.
Sounds like someone who should run a barbecue shack or something.
Yeah.
But this came from a gentleman who was a bouncer in Flagstaff, Arizona, and spent a lot of time talking with truckers, and this story kept popping up. Apparently, Smokey Joe was a trucker who died in a spectacular crash. His truck burned up with him in it. Supposedly, there are sections of highway in northern Arizona where Smokey Joe prowls. And truckers have said they've seen this black 18-wheeler. Oftentimes, it will be coming at them from the wrong side of the road, coming straight at them, chase them. And the story goes that if Smokey Joe catches you, and supposedly he'll sometimes pick up hitchhikers, which gets us back to what we were talking about a minute ago, Smokey Joe will, if he captures these people, he rather demonically locks them up in his truck, and they slowly starve to death.
Oh boy.
Yeah, I mean it's creepy.
Yeah, it's creepy.
Really creepy. And you know, the folks telling these stories are the guys who do this for a living. So I think it's interesting that, you know, I really everybody likes, enjoys a good tall tale, but it does seem kind of interesting that there's, you know, the same stories and the same geographic areas too. Maybe where there's Smokey Joe, there's fire. I don't know. But basically that's one of the stories that's kind of interesting that I heard.
That's creepy.
It is. Yeah. It really is. I mean, it's got a very kind of demonic sort of a feel to it. And one that I received from a good friend of mine who basically his father was a trucker, and this is an experience that he had. He was traveling on the Western Kentucky Parkway, which it runs, and he came along this road that runs parallel to the parkway. And the road doesn't appear on any maps. And he proceeded to follow this road, and eventually he came to a town, which also did not appear on any maps. The town was like a ghost town. There were gas stations, there were houses, restaurants, lights were on, no people, no cars, nothing, just this literally a ghost town. And he obviously passed through this place and got out of there as quick as he possibly could. And at talking to some of his buddies, he found out that other people had the same experience. Basically, eventually, he made it back onto Route 54 and lived the tale to tell. But, you know, basically, it was just a town that didn't exist. And, again, kind of eerie if you were driving along the highway and, you know, one of the stories I picked up was someone had been driving a truck and they got off at an exit, and at first they thought maybe they had taken the wrong exit, and they continued going for what seemed like a really long time. They came across a toll booth. There was no one in the toll booth. It was automated, so they were able to get through it. And after a while, the driver of the truck began to think that perhaps he was on a piece of highway that was under construction, was not open to the public yet. There was no cars, nothing. And the amount of time that he was on this road seemed to be, for him, hours. When he got home and basically found his way back to, got his bearings and found his way back to some place he recognized, there was a differential in his time.
Lost time?
Yes, lost time, exactly. And that, again, something that he found out was not unusual just to him, that other drivers had similar experiences.
We get, Rod, all kinds of stories. Lost time, UFOs, angels, Bigfoot running across the road from truck drivers. I mean, they see everything out there.
You know, if you think about it, huge sections of our country are wilderness, and the only thing that really connects them are these highways. And truckers are they're kind of like the pioneers. They're the folks who, you know, they travel these wastelands, and they're going to see some interesting things. They're going to see some very, you know, a lot of unexplainable things. Some of the stories I got involve UFOs. Others involve lost time. One was interesting. It was a encounter with a car that looked like it was probably from like the 1930s, complete with a driver that looked like he was dressed from the 1930s. that literally
a time traveling like, car.
A time traveling car, exactly. It wasn't even a DeLorean. So
yeah.
I mean, there's just, it's a lot of fascinating phenomena. And if you think about it, it's wilderness out there. There's a lot of territory that, you know, the only thing connecting these towns and cities a lot of times is these highways.
You have touched on in your book the Black Eyed Kids and Shadow People. How did you weave that in?
Well, I have to tell you that you and your show are an enormous resource for me.
Oh, great.
I have been listening to you as long as I can remember. And I think I started listening when Art Bell was originally
mm-hmm.
on the show.
Okay.
And I actually remember the first night you were on, and I really enjoyed the show.
That was April 28th, 2001.
That was not too long after my daughter was born.
Oh, it was a Sunday night. I was filling in for Ian Punnett. It was a long time ago. My God!
And you know, and I really enjoy the show. And I've heard a lot of the stories that you've covered, and a lot of the different phenomena that you've investigated. And I wanted to work some of that stuff into the book, into the novel. And I was interested more in some of the more current phenomena. I was trying to look at things that the shadow people go back a long time. And I actually have a trucker story involving a shadow person. The truck driver was driving along the road in broad daylight and came, you know, on the road, on one side of the road, he saw a grove of trees and appeared to be someone standing under the grove of trees right by the side of the road, almost like they're hitchhiking or perhaps they're waiting for a ride or something like that. And the trucker drove past, and as he got closer and started to pass the individual, the individual was matte black. It was completely black, every part of them. He could make out that appeared like they had some kind of a hat or something on, but all of their features were blotted out.
Like a shadow.
Like a shadow in broad daylight. And I thought that was kind of fascinating. Black-eyed children, what I thought was interesting is, you know, that phenomena really started to appear, as far as we know, in the 90s and became pretty prevalent from the 90s forward. And I was really fascinated by that phenomena, and I decided I was going to use black-eyed children and shadow people in the novel. I actually figured out a way to kind of connect them. Of course, that's through fiction, but I did connect the two phenomena. And there are I have not gotten any decent stories or reports of black-eyed children on truckers. However, there's a lot of black-eyed kid cases where
if you're a truck driver, though, don't pick up any black-eyed kids.
No, and see, that's what the
don't let them into your cab.
Exactly. There's a lot of stories of folks who are like in a parking lot. And, a lot of times when you get in your car for several minutes, you're adjusting your seatbelt, you might check your phone or whatever before you get going. And a lot of these stories are basically people in cars, these children walk up to them, they start to talk to them and ask them if they can get a ride, usually to go home or something like that. They're very insistent. They usually speak in a monotone voice. And initially, the individual usually doesn't notice their eyes, but once they notice their eyes, they realize these are not normal people. They're not. There's some sort of a supernatural entity, and a lot of the stories indicate that the children will begin to say, you know, open the door, let us in, let us come in.
Yeah.
Sometimes they seem to have almost a hypnotic quality to them that sort of mesmerizes the person and makes them want to open the door. Now, we don't know what happens if you open the door for a black-eyed child.
Yes, we do.
But there have been a lot of stories where these entities have shown up in around cars or in parking lots, on streets. They usually are traveling in a pair. They seem to get angry if you refuse to let them in. And what's interesting is, if you recall, you know, the old vampire mythology was you had to invite a vampire into your personal space. You had to invite them into your home. And it seems to be something of that in the black-eyed kid stories, is that they you have to give in and allow them in. And these are stories that I found really fascinating, and they were still connected to transportation, the highways and travel, people in cars. So I decided I wanted to work them into the story, and I enjoyed doing it a lot. And like I said, your show and your audience are just an invaluable resource.
Just an amazing audience, Rod.
Really?
And the stories they
come. Listening to the show, and I love listening to folks who call in, because you get such a wide range of people, and they've all had these experiences, and it's really terrific that they have a place that they can share them.
Well, Friday nights, of course, we devote open lines, and after we're done chatting with you, you can just about imagine the kind of calls we're going to get tonight.
I hope you get some good calls.
They're going to be everywhere.
I'm looking forward to hearing what folks have to say.
And we're going to take calls next hour with Rod Belcher. His book is called The Brotherhood of the Wheel. His website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com for you right now. Rod, when we come back, let's talk a little bit about the Occult Crime Task Force as well, what that is and how that was formed, because you were part of that, weren't you?
Yeah, it's something from my days in college. Yeah.
Okay, we will do that. So much to talk about. And also, just keep your dial exactly where it is all night long.